Content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from The Week magazine. Today, we're reading from the December 30th, 2022, January 6th, 2023 issue of The Week. And we are in our year-end issue of The Week magazine, titled The Faces of 2022. And as always, an interesting cover drawing. This year, it's a winter scene and looks like war-torn Ukraine. A group of famous people are gathered around. Looks like they're singing Christmas carols. There's a barrel fire standing beside it are Volodymyr Zelensky and Joe Biden. Behind them are Liz Cheney and Senator Joe Manchin, the new Supreme Court Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson. And off to the right, with arms around each other, smiling, are Justices Clarence Thomas and Samuel Alito. Behind them, we see former Prince Charles, now King Charles of England, putting a crown on his head. Off to the left are Florida Governor Ron DeSantis and Elon Musk palling together and singing. There is an image of Vladimir Putin carved into a tree with a red handprint on it. Further back, we see Chinese President Xi Jinping. He's got on one of those hazmat suits for the COVID protocol. And way in the background, standing in a apartment building with flames around his feet and his hands on his hip, is a small Donald Trump. The faces of 2022. And we will start today with the editor's letter. Before that, just a comment. We will get 2 weeks out of this magazine. We'll start with the newsy stuff this week and do the year in review program next week. So the editor's letter. It is below freezing now in Ukraine, and for tens of millions of people, the hostile grip of winter is unrelieved by electric light, heat, and running water. Unbowed, Ukrainians huddle in 4,000 points of invisibility throughout the country, public shelters where they can find light, warmth, and comfort. From above, Vladimir Putin's pitiless missile and drone bombardment continues as he empties his arsenals to punish every Ukrainian man, woman, and child for defying his genocidal wish to erase them. Hanukkah's arrival this week could not have been more perfectly timed. The holiday commemorates a miraculous Jewish victory over more numerous oppressors, and is celebrated with the lighting of the menorah candles. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky, who is Jewish, called attention to the symbolism after lighting of a giant menorah in Kyiv. "Light defeated darkness," he said. "It will be the same this time." The year 2022 will be remembered most of all for Ukraine's stunning stand against Russia's armed forces. War transformed Zelensky, a former TV comedian many dismissed as a lightweight, into a Churchillian leader who inspired his countrymen with his unwavering courage and his faith that they will prevail. In a world that often seems dark and filled with predators, Zelensky reminds us of the many magnificent human beings who devote themselves to causes larger than themselves, who bring light wherever they go. He and Ukraine fight not only for themselves, but for all of us who enjoy the benefits of freedom and democracy. It's a world war by proxy, pitting the West against Tsar Putin's fantasies of a restored Russian empire. China's Xi Jinping is paying close attention as he mulls an invasion of Taiwan and seeks to prove the superiority of and expand authoritarian rule. Neither Ukraine nor its democratic allies can afford to lose this war. Light a candle for Ukraine this Hanukkah and Christmas and send ammunition. That was William Falk, the editor-in-chief of The Week. First main story. January 6th panel urges Trump's prosecution. What happened? The January 6th committee unanimously recommended this week that the Department of Justice charge Donald Trump with four crimes related to his efforts to overturn the 2020 election. In a step unprecedented in American history, the committee said the former president should be prosecuted for assisting an insurrection, conspiracy to defraud the United States, making false statements to the federal government, and obstructing an official congressional proceeding. The joint session interrupted by the mob that stormed the Capitol on January 6, 2021. The referrals carry no legal weight, but the panel is turning over to the DOJ and Special Counsel Jack Smith the voluminous evidence it compiled over 18 months of investigation, including reams of documents, memos, text messages, and interviews with more than 1,000 witnesses. In its final public meeting, the panel released a 154-page summary of its findings. It laid out how Trump knowingly lied about widespread election fraud that his top aide said did not exist, pressured state officials and Vice President Mike Pence to overturn the election, and ultimately incited his supporters to march on the Capitol and fight like hell. He then refused multiple pleas to call them off and attacked Pence by tweet, even as Pence and lawmakers scurried for their lives and 138 police officers were injured, some seriously. The evidence has led to an overriding and straightforward conclusion, said the report. The central cause of January 6 was one man, former President Donald Trump. The panel recommended that the DOJ investigate five Trump allies as potential co-conspirators, including former Chief of Staff Mark Meadows and former Attorney Rudy Giuliani. It also referred four Republican House members to the House Ethics Committees for defying its subpoenas: Jim Jordan of Ohio, Scott Perry of Pennsylvania, Andy Biggs of Arizona, and Kevin McCarthy of California, who is seeking to become the next speaker. Biggs called the referral a political stunt and said he looked forward to setting the record straight when Republicans assume House control next year. Trump called the panel a kangaroo court and its work a partisan effort to sideline me and the Republican Party. What the editorial said. The committee has built a powerful case for pursuing prosecution, said the Los Angeles Times. Over 18 months, it compiled a damning record that should shock and repel anyone not blinded by partisanship or enthralled to the cult of Trump. A criminal referral is unprecedented, but so are the criminal transgressions of a defeated president who engineered a sprawling conspiracy to upend the Constitution. The panel's political gesture carries all the force of an inner office memo, said the Wall Street Journal. Yes, January 6 was a disgrace, and Trump should never again hold office. But it's the DOJ's job to decide whether there's sufficient evidence to win a conviction and whether locking up an ex-president would serve the nation's interests. The answer to both is no. Prosecuting Trump would cleave the country in two and could plunge American democracy into a new and dangerous era. What the columnist said. How much the committee swayed public opinion isn't clear, said Ankush Kardori in Politico, but its work did create a remarkable shift in the political and legal dynamics surrounding a possible Trump indictment. With its artfully staged hearings and steady stream of incriminating new details, it seems to have forced the hand of the cautious Attorney General Merrick Garland, who seemed reluctant to confront Trump. As Smith takes over the case, we are seeing the public handoff of an extraordinary effort that could end up with Trump behind bars. Garland, Smith, and DOJ prosecutors are cowards if they don't indict Trump, said Ely Mistel in The Nation. These crimes, everybody saw and heard him commit. He lied about the election results and blatantly pushed a scheme to submit false electors. That is fraud. He literally sent an armed mob to the Capitol to block the vote certification. That's obstruction of Congress. Garland and Smith just need to simply do their jobs. Congress is an innately political body, said Andrew McCarthy in the New York Post, which is why the committee's criminal referral may actually hurt a prosecution. It helps Trump argue that any indictment is politically motivated, no matter how strong the case. He can accurately claim that Biden's DOJ took no action until a Democrat-dominated committee demanded it. That transparent ploy won't hold up in court, said David Frum in The Atlantic. For 6 years, Trump escaped consequences as he obstructed the Mueller probe, tried to extort Ukraine's president to help his 2020 re-election campaign, walked off with classified documents, and repeatedly disdained the rule of law. But inciting a violent insurrection so he could stay in power is not something that can be forgiven by any political system that hopes to stay constitutional. At long last, the time for justice has come. Second main story, crisis at the border as pandemic measure may end. What happened? U.S. cities along the Mexican border braced for a massive influx of migrants this week as the Supreme Court considered lifting the emergency health measure that prevented people from claiming asylum. Title 42, which allows border officials to immediately expel asylum seekers rather than processing their claims, has been in effect since March 2020, when the Trump administration said it was necessary to keep out COVID, and some 2.5 million people have been expelled under it. A federal judge last month ordered it repealed by December 21st, but Chief Justice John Roberts issued a temporary hold after an emergency request from 19 Republican-led states, saying that Title 42 was no longer supported by public health conditions. The Biden administration asked the court this week to lift the measure on December 27th. If that happens, the Department of Homeland Security said the number of border crossings could double, reaching up to 14,000 a day. Tens of thousands of the many migrants waiting in Mexico, including Venezuelans, Nicaraguans, Haitians, and Cubans, have already begun crossing the border in anticipation of the repeal. In El Paso, Texas, more than 35,000 migrants have entered since December 1, overwhelming shelters. Hundreds of people, including families with sick children, were camping outside in public places around the city, some lighting bonfires as temperatures dropped into the 20s. Similar conditions prevailed in Yuma, Arizona, population 97,000, where border agents have been detaining 1,000 migrants a day. Both cities have declared states of emergency. White House Press Secretary Karine Jean-Pierre rejected suggestions that the region had fallen into disorder. The border is not open, she said. We're doing the smuggler's job if we spread misinformation. What the editorial said. The border is out of control, said the New York Post, and Biden isn't doing anything about it. More than 4 million attempted land crossings have been recorded during his presidency. And though fellow Democrats such as El Paso Mayor Oscar Leeser have bent over backward not to embarrass him over the issue, they've reached a breaking point. Even New York Mayor Eric Adams is complaining about the 30,000 asylum seekers bused to his city this year. No one has helped us, he said. No one. Title 42 was never the solution, said the San Antonio Express News. It is a public health code, not immigration law, and it actually inspires repeat crossings because repelled migrants aren't entered in the system and can keep trying again. Still, it's abundantly clear that the country doesn't have a functional immigration system, and that means Congress must act. We need laws that will give asylum seekers a quick and fair hearing of their claims while also assuring Americans a safe and secure border. What the columnist said. What we have now is the worst of both worlds, said William Galston in the Wall Street Journal. Biden's policies have given us a surge in unauthorized migration, coupled with a shortfall of legal immigrants that the labor market needs. Once Title 42 is repealed, the president will face a moment of truth. He'll be forced to toughen border enforcement, and he won't be able to blame it on Trump. America's dysfunctional duct-taped border policy is not the fault of the White House alone, said Zachary Wolf in CNN.com. Congress hasn't passed a comprehensive immigration reform bill since 1986, and we badly need one. But there's no consensus to be had. Republican governors showboat by haphazardly shipping migrants to the northern states, while Democrats refuse to acknowledge there is a crisis. Meanwhile, thanks to a crisis of democracy in the hemisphere, ever more people are fleeing authoritarian countries like Nicaragua and Venezuela to come here. The latest attempt at a bipartisan grand bargain is headed for failure, too, said Roberto Suro in the Washington Post. Senators Tom Tillis, Republican from North Carolina, and Kyrsten Sinema, the independent from Arizona, recently reached a deal that would have given millions a path to citizenship, extended Title 42, and increased border enforcement, but it lacks enough Republican support to overcome a filibuster. Now the cost of paralysis will escalate. Our punitive border system and an asylum process designed for Soviet-era defectors will start to collapse. Without reform, we're facing an era of mounting chaos, economic loss, and tragedy. And we'll flip the page for the good week, bad week piece. It was a good week for having space, with a reported surge in the number of U.S. married couples who live apart so they don't get on each other's nerves. About 4 million married Americans currently live separately from their spouses, the U.S. Census Bureau said, a 25% increase from the year 2000. It was a good week for female snakes, with the discovery they not only have clitorises, but actually have two of them. I was just kind of jumping up and down, said Australian biologist Megan Falwell, who found the organs during a dissection of a dead Australian death adder. And it was a good week for fake extraterrestrials, after the original animatronic model of the alien from Steven Spielberg's 1982 film E.T. sold at auction to an anonymous bidder for $2.56 million. But it was a bad week for real extraterrestrials after the Pentagon's new All-Domain Anomaly Resolution Office said its review of hundreds of UFO sightings, including dozens of new ones in recent months, did not show any evidence of aliens visiting Earth at this time. It was a bad week for iconoclasts, with a new data analysis of 11 million adults showing that people who have chosen not to be vaccinated against COVID are 72% more likely to be involved in serious traffic accidents. Researchers theorize that anti-vaxxers so distrust authority that they defiantly neglect basic road safety guidelines. Finally, it was a bad week for kink, after an 88-year-old man arrived at a French hospital asking for help in removing an 8-inch-long World War II artillery shell lodged in his rectum, causing a bomb scare and an emergency evacuation. After determining the shell was inert, doctors removed it. And a short and other news piece, $1.7 trillion spending deal to avoid shutdown. A bipartisan group of senators appeared to avert a government shutdown this week, voting 70 to 25 to begin debate on a $1.7 trillion bill to fund the government. To win over Republicans, Democrats signed on for more than $800 billion in defense spending. While both parties agreed to spending increases on child care programs and substance abuse initiatives. Democrats failed to get expanded child tax credits, while Republicans tried and failed to preserve corporate tax breaks. Some Senate Republicans pushed to delay negotiations until the GOP takes control of the House next year. GOP House Leader Kevin McCarthy threatened retaliation, warning that any bill coming out of the Senate next year will be dead on arrival in a GOP-led House. And we'll run through some of the short pieces from the U.S. at a glance and the world at a glance this week. Starting with the U.S. at a glance, Eureka, California, severe quake. A magnitude 6.4 earthquake in the early morning shattered windows and damaged roads in rural Humboldt County this week, leaving at least 2 dead, 11 injured, and tens of thousands without power. About 10 seconds before homes started shaking, 3 million Northern California residents received a phone alert reading, "Earthquake detected. Drop cover. Hold on. Protect yourself." The region has experienced more than 40 earthquakes of magnitude 6 to 7 in the past 100 years. A historic bridge in Ferndale was damaged and closed, and many people reported dishes shattering and mirrors falling. Arcata residents Amy Uyeki and Reese Hughes were asleep when the quake hit, knocking their power out immediately. "Afterwards, you feel sort of dizzy," said Uyeki, 67. The couple said the shaking lasted about 15 seconds, and it was followed by an estimated 80 aftershocks. Los Angeles. Weinstein convicted again. Jurors this week found disgraced Hollywood producer Harvey Weinstein guilty of showing up at an Italian actress hotel room uninvited and raping her during an L.A. film festival in 2013. The new conviction all but ensured that the accuser's wish that Weinstein, 70, never sees the outside of a prison cell during his lifetime will come true, since he's currently just 2 years into a 23-year sentence for a New York rape conviction. L.A. jurors deadlocked on sexual assault accusations against Weinstein from three other women, including Jennifer Siebel Newsom, a documentary filmmaker and wife of California Governor Gavin Newsom. She testified to being raped by Weinstein in a hotel room in 2005, but jurors deadlocked on the charges 8-4. Defense attorneys said if Siebel Newsom hadn't reached her eventual prominence, she'd just be another bimbo who slept with Harvey Weinstein to get ahead in Hollywood, adding, "Regret is not the same thing as rape." Nassau County, New York. Freshman fabulist. Newly elected House Republican George Santos appears to have fabricated past employers, the colleges he attended, his sources of income, and other aspects of his self-proclaimed American Dream resume. The New York Times reported this week, Santos, 34, the gay son of Brazilian immigrants, flipped a Democratic-leaning district, helping the GOP gain its slim House majority. In his campaign, Santos boasted of being a seasoned Wall Street financier, but the two financial firms listed on Santos' biography, Citigroup and Goldman Sachs, say he never worked there. And Baruch College and New York University said he never attended the schools. State regulators and the IRS could find no records at all of the pet rescue charity Santos claims to run. Santos refused to address any specific allegations, saying only that the Times was trying to smear his good name. Washington, D.C. Trump's taxes. The IRS failed to audit Donald Trump during the first 2 years of office and never completed an audit while he was president, violating a requirement for sitting presidents, the House Ways and Means Committee disclosed this week. The revelation contradicted Trump's claims that an audit prevented him from releasing his tax returns. After a legal battle that went to Supreme Court, the House Democrats released 6 years of Trump's returns, exposing deductions that have prompted an IRS review. The returns show Trump claimed years of steep losses. His income jumped to $24 million in his third year as president, but in 2020, he again claimed a multi-million dollar loss. The IRS began an audit of Trump only in April 2019, on the same day that the House asked for Trump's information, and assigned just one agent to the job. Charles Rettig, a Trump appointee who served as head of the IRS until last month, claimed that the agency was simply outgunned. And also from Washington, D.C., visit from a war zone. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky left his country for this week for the first time since Russia's invasion, riding secretly on a train to Poland, then flying in a U.S. military plane to meet with President Biden in the Oval Office before addressing a joint session of Congress. Congress is poised to pass $45 billion in additional military and economic aid for Ukraine, bringing total American assistance during the war to over $100 billion. The U.S. recently agreed to include the top-of-the-line Patriot air defense system. Republicans are growing increasingly wary of the extraordinary spending, with Republican House Leader Kevin McCarthy saying Ukraine shouldn't expect a blank check from the GOP-controlled House. Zelensky has astutely sought to speak to American audiences. In an interview with David Letterman, the comedian-turned-president cracked jokes before telling audiences more seriously, "The war ends when we reclaim our land and our borders." And the world at a glance, starting in Montreal, Global Biodiversity Pact. Nearly all the world's countries agreed at a UN summit this week to protect 30% of the planet's land and oceans by 2030. At least 1 million plants and animals are at risk of disappearing thanks to human encroachment, in what would be the biggest extinction event since the dinosaurs. The Kunming-Montreal Agreement is a scale of conservation that we haven't seen, haven't ever attempted before, said Brian O'Donnell, director of the Coalition Campaign for Nature. The U.S., which is not a party to the U.N. Convention on Biological Diversity, because Senate Republicans have blocked ratification for decades, was one of just four countries that didn't sign the pact. President Biden issued an executive order to protect 30% of U.S. land and water, but it doesn't have the force of law. Aguas Calientes, Peru. Tourists airlifted out. Hundreds of international tourists, including Americans, were evacuated from Machu Picchu by helicopter this week after they were stranded when rail service to the ancient site was cut. Travel is ground to a halt across the country as rioters angry over former President Pedro Castillo's ouster earlier this month blocked roads and rail tracks. At least 25 people have died in clashes that erupted between security forces and Castillo supporters, and massive protests and strikes continue, particularly in rural areas. The new president, Dina Boluarte, has declared a state of emergency across the entire country. Castillo, who tried to dissolve Congress to avoid impeachment, is in jail. Buenos Aires. Messi feted as hero. Argentina declared a national holiday this week to to celebrate the country's World Cup victory. Superstar captain Lionel Messi and the rest of the national soccer team cruised in an open-top bus through the throng of some 4 million fans in Buenos Aires, singing the unofficial anthem of the tournament, Muchachos, ahora nos volvimos a ilusionar. The team couldn't reach the obelisk downtown because the crowd there was too densely packed. Instead, players piled into helicopters and soared overhead. Argentina has been suffering an economic crisis for years, and fully 1 in 10 citizens turned out for this street party. Many of them climbed up awnings, flagpoles, even the sides of buildings for a glimpse of the bus. They get up there because this is Argentina, one woman told the newspaper, Clarín, and we are the craziest in the world. Kyiv, candles in the darkness. Hours after Russia's latest drone attack on its power grid, Kyiv officials plugged the lights of the city's 39-foot Christmas tree into a generator in St. Sophia Square this week, illuminating it in blue and gold for a clapping, defiant crowd. The country's tiny Jewish minority, which includes President Volodymyr Zelensky, also celebrated a wartime festival of lights in Kyiv, lighting Hanukkah candles on a giant menorah at a ceremony attended by the mayor. I say to the Ukrainian people every day, we are the light, said Ukraine's chief rabbi, Moshe Reuven Osman, and we push away the darkness. Tokyo, dangers of road sleeping. Tokyo police are running a video in tens of thousands of taxis, warning people not to drink so much this holiday season that they fall asleep while staggering home. They're also asking taxi and truck drivers to keep their high beams on at night. At least 13 people have died so far this year after passing out on the street, double last year's road sleeping toll. In Japan, December is the hard-drinking Bonnenkei, literally forget the year, season, when businesses throw wild bacchanalia for employees. Normally, workers would take hired cars home, but car services say the pandemic has made them cut down on their fleets and deprived them of drivers. On weekends, there are 2.5-hour waits for a ride home, one car company executive told the Mainichi Shimbun. Nairobi, Kenya. Facebook blamed in Ethiopia killings. The son of an Ethiopian academic who was murdered during the country's civil war has filed a $1.6 billion lawsuit against Facebook parent company Meta in Kenya's high court. U.S.-based researcher Abram Mirag Amare says his father, a Tigrayan professor, was killed last year after Facebook refused to remove posts that shared his address and falsely accused him of militant ties. I knew it was a death sentence for my father the moment I saw it, Abram told NPR. The suit alleges that Facebook's algorithm promotes hateful and violent content, and that the company lacks adequate moderators for African languages. Meta said it had taken action on 92,000 posts in Ethiopia in the 6 months before the professor's death. Some 500,000 people died in Ethiopia's Tigray region during the 2-year war that ended in November. Buera, Uganda. Toddler survives hippo attack. Quick-thinking passerby saved a 2-year-old boy last week from a hippo that had taken the child almost entirely into its mouth. Little Paul Iga was playing near his home on the shore of Lake Edward when the hippopotamus emerged from the waters and chomped him. It took the bravery of one Crispas Bagonza, who was nearby, to save the victim, said a spokesperson for Uganda police. He stoned the hippo and scared it, causing it to release the victim. The injured boy was taken to the hospital, where he was treated for his wounds and vaccinated for rabies. Hippos can weigh up to 1.5 tons, and though they are mostly herbivorous, they can be extremely aggressive. Some 500 people are killed in Africa each year by hippos, more than by lions or crocodiles. And we'll pick up some of the best columns of the week. First two come from the U.S., starting with Our Kinship with Ukraine. A military behemoth attacks a fledgling nation and dismisses the rebels as little more than a rebellious colony that will soon be crushed. But patriots rush to their homeland's defense and, with vital military aid provided by other nations, shock the world by beating back their supposedly invincible foe as a brutal winter sets in. That, said Dave Donaldson, is the story of both Ukraine's war and the American Revolution, which could not have succeeded without vital help from the French, Spanish, and Dutch. Today, the front lines in the battle against tyranny are found in Odessa, Kharkiv, Kherson, and Kyiv, rather than Concord and Yorktown, as barbaric Russian missile and drone attacks on Ukraine's power grid leave millions shivering in the dark without heat or light. Russian Tsar Vladimir Putin is trying to break the will of the brave Ukrainians, and we Americans cannot abandon them in their fight for survival. We must assure these freedom fighters of this new era they do not fight alone, and send them weapons and generators so they can continue to fight and ultimately eject the invaders from their land. Aggression left unchecked is a threat to liberty everywhere. We are all Ukrainians now. The myth of the single town square. In real life, people do not choose to spend time with people who have conflicting worldviews, said Noah Smith. So why would they want to do that online? The reason why the internet now feels like a place we need to flee from, why social media platforms like Twitter are frequently described as hell sites and toxic, is that they try to force the whole world into a single room. The techno-utopians' experiment in uniting the human race in a virtual town square was based on the theory that if we could just get people to leave their bubbles and talk to each other, the old world of war and hate and misunderstanding would melt into memory. This experiment has failed. As Elon Musk is now discovering, human beings are fundamentally tribal, not rational, and getting insulted and dunked on by people who disagree with you doesn't make you consider their opinions or change your mind. It makes you retreat back inside your bubble. The internet actually wants to be fragmented, a place where people find like-minded communities with certain shared assumptions and interests. Like it or not, human beings are not ready for a single public square. This column comes from the UK. Harry and Meghan burn their bridges. Harry and Meghan's Netflix documentary series is nauseating, tawdry, and staggeringly narcissistic, said Piers Morgan in The Sun. Over six tedious hours, the Duke and Duchess of Sussex show us their weak, whiny, self-absorbed world, painting themselves as noble victims hounded out of a bigoted country. I expected no better from Meghan, a grasping social climber who cries racism anytime someone fails to pay her sufficient compliments. But I'm outraged at Harry, whose betrayal of his family and his country has now been laid bare in hideous, eye-popping detail. Harry tattles about the fateful 2020 family meeting at the Queen's Sandringham country home, called after he and Meghan announced they'd be stepping away from some royal duties and moving to California. He claims his father, King Charles, lied to his face while his brother, Prince William, screamed at him with terrifying fury. The disloyalty is breathtaking, as is the hypocrisy. Harry is apparently too dense to realize how ridiculous it is to talk of protecting his family's privacy as he simultaneously flaunts his children in front of cameras to the world for millions of dollars. If royalty is such a horrible burden, why don't he and his wife renounce their titles? Instead, these shameless grifters happily trade on the very institution they smear. Netflix paid a reported $100 million to the couple for this series and a slew of programming to come, said Richard Kay in the Daily Mail, and it got its money's worth. This was a bout of family score settling that was as ruthless as it was merciless. The only thing that comes close is the notorious interview Princess Diana gave to the BBC 27 years ago when she shredded Charles' reputation by telling of his cheating. Like his mother, Harry sees conspiracy and sinister forces lurking behind every closed palace door and wallows in self-pity. The Sussexes have absolutely no shame, said Jan Waugh, also in the Daily Mail. Recently, I watched as the self-satisfied couple promoted their documentary at a New York City gala where they actually received a Human Rights Award, the Ripple of Hope Award presented by the Robert F. Kennedy Foundation, for standing up to racism in the royal family. I could only thank God that the Queen wasn't alive to witness this grisly but typically successful spectacle, treachery masquerading as philanthropy under the glittering Manhattan chandeliers. Calm down, said Jonathan Friedland in The Guardian. Harry and Meghan are simply doing what the British public has always expected of the monarchy, providing diversion for us commoners. Netflix's tale of a royal clan riven in factions, a misunderstood and mistreated young royal, and a star-crossed romance is classic Buckingham Palace. For my parents' generation, the sympathetic star of the show was Princess Margaret, forbidden to marry her divorced and therefore unsuitable true love. My generation was gripped by Diana's saga. Now my kids have the fable of Harry and Meghan. These two may have broken with the royal family, but they're still in the royal business. This column comes from Kenya. Can the U.S. catch up to China? The United States is stridently upping its game in Africa, said Peter Kagwanja. President Joe Biden tried to reconnect with the continent last week by hosting 49 African leaders at the three-day U.S. African Leaders Summit in Washington, D.C., promising a free trade deal, $55 billion in investments over the next 3 years, and support for an African seat on the G20. His efforts mark a radical shift in America's African policy. But will it be enough? America neglected the continent for years through the benign disinterest of the Obama administration and the open disdain of the Trump years, allowing China to swoop in and become Africa's main trade partner. Beijing not only struck mining deals for crucial minerals, but also financed roads and railroads and sent in Chinese firms to build them. And unlike U.S. funds, Chinese money is famously no strings attached, since Beijing doesn't pressure African leaders over human rights abuses or democratic backsliding. Fortunately for Africa, U.S. competition with China needn't be a zero-sum game. There's room here for investments from both countries, as long as the U.S. treats Africa as an autonomous continent with its own dreams and interests, not as a theater of geopolitical tussles. And this from Saudi Arabia. The danger of Iran's revolution. Arab nations gleefully watching Iran's uprising should be careful what they wish for, said Dania Khalilat Khatib. The protests began as a woman's rebellion against the law mandating hijab and the morality police who enforce it, but they quickly morphed into a rejection of the entire theocratic system of government. The regime has never been more threatened. Even the sister of Supreme Leader Ayatollah Ali Khamenei has come out publicly calling for its downfall. This is a dangerous moment. If the regime were to become desperate, it could take desperate measures. Already since the protests began, Iran has launched ballistic missiles across the border with Iraq to hit Kurdish-Iranian opposition bases. It could try to divert the people's attention with a major provocation against its Arab enemies. Even if the regime falls, the likely replacement wouldn't be a democratic government, but merely the facade of one backed by the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps. The international community may hope to engineer a soft landing by reaching out to moderates such as former President Mohammad Khatami, but at this point, any foreign interference might even make the situation worse. Iran's fate is in Iranian hands, and all the rest of us can do is wait and see. And we'll read a few of the Talking Points articles. We'll start with Sandy Hook. 10 years later, little has changed. Jackie Hegarty will never forget the 5 minutes that changed her life, said Sandra Diamond Fox in the Danbury, Connecticut News Times. She was a second grader when a disturbed 20-year-old with a Bushmaster XM15 semi-automatic rifle walked into Sandy Hook Elementary School in Newtown, Connecticut. 10 years ago last week. In minutes, he bathed its classroom in blood, executing 20 first and second graders and 6 adults. Hegarty, now 17, recalls her classmates being led out in line and told to shut their eyes. When she opened hers, she saw horrific things no 7-year-old should have to see. Those images still haunt her, and she was left with trauma, survivor's guilt, and a hypervigilance that has her constantly looking for hiding spots and doors. Every place I go, she said, I have to know how to get out. The horrors of Sandy Hook shocked the nation, said Melissa Segura in BuzzFeed News. But the carnage has only continued to mount. Since then, gun violence has become the leading cause of death for children in this country, and at least 117 more K-12 students and teachers have been killed. Many of us thought 20 murdered school children would be America's last straw, said Jim Rulland in the Los Angeles Times. But months after Newtown, we watched in stunned rage as a bill expanding background checks for gun buyers failed in the Senate. And since then, many states have actually loosened their gun laws. The result is a drumbeat of mass shootings in schools, churches, synagogues, supermarkets, concert venues, and other public places that have ripped a hole in the fabric of our nation. Will we ever put a stop to this madness? On a federal level, gun laws are largely unchanged since Sandy Hook, said Matt Ballantyne in The New Republic. But the tragedy did spark a movement that's pushed through sweeping gun laws in numerous states. In Connecticut, families this year won a precedent-shattering $73 million settlement from Remington for advertising the XM15, with language targeting insecure and unstable young men, like the Newtown killer. That's small comfort, said the Connecticut Post in an editorial. What we are left with, then, is grief, for the many lives cut short, and the knowledge that our country's gun culture and permissive gun laws make mass shootings like Sandy Hook both possible and inevitable. We must never fail to be shocked that it happened. Triple-demic. To mask or not to mask. If it seems like everyone around you is getting sick, they are, said Katie Camaro in BuzzFeed News. The triple-demic of COVID, flu, and RSV is in full force as the holidays arrive, with rising hospitalization rates and one of the worst flu and cold seasons on record. Young children and the elderly are the most likely to get seriously ill. Major pharmacies are limiting purchases of children's pain relievers due to demand, and almost 90% of COVID deaths, which are averaging about 380 a week, are people over 65. Still, only 36% of seniors have received the new bivalent booster, despite CDC data showing that it decreases the risk of hospitalization by 73% for that age group compared with those who got the original two doses and boosters. Wearing a mask is in high-risk situations can also help people avoid respiratory infections, said Leanna Nguyen in the Washington Post. Many people find a high-quality N95 or KN95 mask uncomfortable to wear over long periods. But remember, mask wearing doesn't have to be all or nothing. You could save them for crowded airports, mass transit, or other public places where lots of people are coughing and sneezing and filling the air with viruses. Nearly 3 years into the pandemic, many Americans are saying, "I'm done with masks," said Paul Thornton in the Los Angeles Times. But scientific evidence shows that masking works. One recent study showed that people wearing cloth masks were 56% less likely to test positive than those without masks. That increased to 66% with surgical masks and 83% with well-fitted N95s and KN95s. And experts strenuously favor masking when transmission is high. Remember, immunity from prior infection and from vaccination wanes after 4 to 6 months, and the new circulating variants are highly infectious. So you can get COVID even if you've had it before or had multiple shots. If you start to feel sick, should you stay home for the holidays? Asked Caroline Mims Nice in The Atlantic. If you have a fever, pretty much everyone agrees that's an absolute no-go. If your symptoms are mainly congestion, consider who you'll be seeing and use extra caution if you're visiting a baby or an elderly relative. The Biden administration is sending every household another 4 free COVID tests, so be sure to utilize them. Everyone wants to see family and friends for the holidays, but giving them COVID, the flu, or even a cold is a pretty lousy present. World Cup. Qatar gets what it paid for. The World Cup just gave us a month of riveting soccer, capped by more than 2 hours of unadulterated joy, said Jason Gay in the Wall Street Journal. The final match this week in Qatar between Argentina and defending champ France was surely among the best sporting events the billion-plus TV viewers will ever see. Argentina raced to a 2-0 lead behind its outgoing superstar, Lionel Messi, 35, but France roared back with a dazzling 3-goal hat trick by the sport's new superstar, Kylian Mbappe, 24. Argentina finally prevailed in a dramatic penalty kick shootout. Other nations had memorable performances, said Alex Shepard in the New Republic, including Japan, Australia, a promising young U.S. team, and Morocco. Despite the corruption and the human rights abuses of temporary workers associated with the 2022 tournament, soccer standing as the global sport was actually strengthened. When Gonzalo Montiel drove home the decisive penalty kick, said The Economist, millions of Argentines streamed into downtown Buenos Aires, setting off firecrackers, chanting songs, and honking car horns. The beautiful game is religion in Argentina, which declared a national holiday to celebrate its first cup in 36 years. It's the crowning achievement for Messi, the diminutive magician who now could reasonably be called the greatest soccer player ever. His team delivered for Argentina after the country suffered through a year of record droughts, a political corruption scandal, and inflation reaching 100%. Argentines needed a jolt of national pride, however temporary it may be. There's an old saying, usually applied to the Olympics, said John Feinstein in the Washington Post, only the athletes save the games. That's certainly true of this World Cup in Qatar, where horrific reports of migrant workers dying as they built the tournament stadiums, government corruption, and refusal to let players or spectators show support for LGBTQ rights were overshadowed by captivating play. In the end, Qatar got what it wanted, said Tariq Panja in the New York Times. The oil-rich nation spent $200 billion on this tournament, in return becoming the center of the world for a month, capped by a beaming Messi donning a bisht, the black cloak worn in the Gulf for special occasions. The thrilling and joyous final will never be forgotten. Given the host country a public relations success, no amount of Qatari wealth could buy. On the poll watch, 55% of Americans believe the U.S. should continue offering asylum to people fleeing persecution abroad. 48% of Democrats believe most or all migrants deserve asylum, compared with 26% of independents, 15% of Republicans. When asked what word best describes their mood as the new year arrives, 39% of Americans chose hopeful, 24% said worried, 11% fearful, and 18% exhausted. And we'll close today's show with a quote from P.J. O'Rourke, quoted in National Review. The two most frightening words in Washington are bipartisan consensus. Bipartisan consensus is like when my doctor and my lawyer agree with my wife that I need help. And with that, we have run out of time for today's episode of the week. Be sure to listen again next time. We hope you have enjoyed it. This is Fred Woodward reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The week is available as a podcast on our website, ncreadingservice.org. For more information or if you have comments or questions, give us a call, 919-832-5138. And thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.